I science fiction. I think it's very unlikely. AC2GS, K2LIW.
AC2GS. I agree with you, Dick. But there are interesting foibles with the equations of quantum mechanics. The theory goes that things that travel below the speed of light can't reach the speed of light, and those things that can only exist at the speed of light can't travel at any other velocity. But there's also a theoretical basis for particles that can only travel faster than the speed of light, and they give those charmingly theoretical particles the term tachyons. It's very, very useful when you're writing a science fiction novel, and you need to get someplace very, very fast.
With all the experiments that have taken place with the Large Hadron Collider, with the alternating gradient synchrotron, with the linear accelerator of Stanford University, with all of these particle accelerators and various experiments, to your knowledge, Roy, has anyone ever seen even the slightest amount of evidence of the existence of a tachyon particle, something that's capable of moving faster than the speed of light? There was that experiment of a couple of years ago where neutrinos going through 700 miles of Earth between Italy and Switzerland looked like they were going 3 nanoseconds faster than the speed of light, and it was found out to be an experimental error. So I don't think there has been any experimental evidence of the existence of a tachyon. AC2GS, K2LIW, the TechNet.
I would agree with you entirely. They are completely theoretical, and most likely, if I was a betting man, I'd bet the house, I'd buy a boat and bet the boat. I don't think it exists. But on a theoretical basis, it sounds even wackier than simply traveling faster than the speed of light, because, as you know, if you take a regular particle at rest, its velocity with frame reference to yourself is zero. And in order to get it as close to the speed of light as possible, you have to supply an infinite amount of energy to accelerate it. Well, tachyons are the exact mirror version of that. At their lowest energy level, they're traveling at an infinite speed. If you apply an almost infinite amount of energy, you can slow a tachyon down to just a little bit faster than the speed of light in the vacuum, at least theoretically. I mean, it'll give you a nosebleed to think about it.
Boy, could the science fiction guys make a lot of fun out of this one. Instead of the engines on the Star Trek Enterprise 1701 having matter and antimatter in its fuel tanks and mixing them together very slowly in a controlled manner to get thrust, all you need is a single tachyon in your fuel tank, and it's somehow traveling in there in some kind of a circular path very fast, and how you keep it in that circular path, we won't worry about that. It would take an infinite amount of magnetic fields or something like that. But still, now you start applying braking energy to it, and you get this tremendous amount of energy back out of the tachyon. Boy, that sounds way too good to be true. Back to you, Roy. Get your eyes on.
But see, you're thinking of it as a regular particle. It's not braking. It's actually, you don't get energy by slowing down a tachyon. You get energy by letting it go faster and faster. It's that completely upside down type of logic. And unfortunately, it's not really good for science fiction that way, because the particles and only the particles travel that fast. So they usually use tachyons to have faster than light radio transmissions, like this gentleman apparently is interested in. Unfortunately, for cases of real matter going faster than the speed of light, they play with wormholes, which are basically Einstein-Rosen bridges. that are also theoretical, or they just rip a hole in space and go through it somehow. That's the usual scam. But I don't think tachyons are going to happen at any time. I don't even know if theoretically they're charged and can emit anything.
N198. N198. KQRIW, N198. That sounds like a set of call letters with nothing but numbers. Correct me, sir. Give us your full call letters and your name. KQRIW, my name is Dick.
Why, certainly, Dick. NY9A, New York 9A. And the name is George. I was formerly K2BIE and used to be an occasional visitor to this hallowed net. I just wanted to drop in and say, when I heard you mention quantum mechanics, my ears started to vibrate. I am familiar with the experiments that have been conducted with the polarizing filters on long lines in which you polarize I'm trying to remember what the heck it is. It's just been so long since I read the experiment. Anyway, if you take a polarized beam that's been running down a mile-long track and split it and change the polarity on one of the split ends, all of a sudden the other end starts to split, which only shows how weird quantum mechanics is. If you're familiar with that, is there anything down that way as far as coming up with new means of communication? Over to you.
Go right ahead with that one, Roy.
Very good. What you are discussing is something called quantum entanglement, which apparently the Chinese are actually playing around with a satellite. A lot of people don't like quantum entanglement. Einstein, although he pretty much authored the original work to describe it, called it wackiness at a distance. I forget exactly the strange phrase that he used about it. He loathed and despised it. There are a lot of experiments that demonstrate quantum entanglement. They theoretically occur instantaneously, faster than the speed of light, but you can't get any information from that system at any speed faster than the speed of light. So that's the little gimmick that allows for entanglement, but makes it kind of worthless other than as an experiment.
Thank you. That was very, very, very lucid, I must say. I think Einstein called it spooky. That was his word.
Right. It's spooky action at a distance.
Precisely. Anyway, I just bring that up only as an example of what a weird world quantum mechanics is, and I really don't know if we have fully scratched that surface. Anyway, I'll just be on the side here listening. I'm enjoying this tremendously.
There are a significant number of people out there, Roy, who want to believe that quantum entanglement is such a thing where you set up these two particles that are quantum entangled, put one of them on a spaceship, so to speak, fly it a long distance away, keep the other one local nearby, and if you do anything to make a measurement or change the state of the one that's nearby, the one that's remote, in theory, instantaneously changes to the opposite, and therefore, in theory, you can send information a long distance in zero time. There are people who want to believe that. And let me show you a couple of problems with that. Every signal that contains unknown information that you and I convey from point A to point B, I say convey, whether it's transmission or whatever, usually contains some number of nanojoules per bit. Whether it's bits of ones and zeros out of your computer, whether it's flashes of light, no matter what. Some number of nanojoules exists in the thing that we call a bit of signal, whether it be binary or hexadecimal or whatever, almost doesn't matter. As such, if quantum entanglement allows you, let me drop. If quantum entanglement allows you to really send a unknown piece of information that fulfills Shannon's laws. Shannon is a beautiful mathematician way back in the early portion of the 20th century who said that the rate of transmission of information is proportional to the degree of unknownness. In other words, if you don't know what's coming, a teacher who sits in front of a room and whistles a 1KC note, you know exactly what he's going to do for the next couple of seconds. That is not information, other than proving he's alive and he can still whistle. That's not real information. So the degree of unknownness of, I'm not using the right word, but you know what I mean. By Shannon's law, you have to not know what's coming, and when it comes, you now know. And each bit of information, by the usual techniques that mankind has used up till now, requires some number of joules or nanojoules or picojoules per bit to send that signal. So if quantum entanglement can instantaneously send an unknown piece of information from point A to point B in less than the amount of time required to speed of light, then it seems to be violating a bunch of laws. It really is a spooky action at a distance, in Einstein's words. KE2VJ is going to straighten this all out AC2GS. Well, straighten this all out of this. K2LAW and the Tech Man.
NWS2N. Well, who knows? Eric might be able to settle this. I mean, this quantum entanglement gives a lot of people headaches. It brings up something called Bell's theorem. It brings up local hidden variables as a reason for how they might be interpreted. I mean, I could give you a really bad example that most physicists would hate. If you had a blue card or a red card, and your Uncle Ned tore the card in half, put one half in a box and handed it to you and told you not to open it, and took another box and put the other half in the box and put it on a rocket ship 10 light years from now, told you to open it on your half, and it was red, then you instantaneously know that the other box has a red card as well. And that information, in a way, traveled all those light years, but really didn't. So that's kind of hidden local variables.
Go ahead, Paul.
Well, I brought up the Chinese with the satellites. They have successfully tested that. They first tested it from city to city. I think it was 100 kilometers or something. But then they decided to try it on a satellite. But they're not interested in trying to beat the speed of light. They're interested in a perfect encryption system for computers, so nobody could hack into these things. So if the guy who's on the spaceship puts in, you know, a zero, and then the guy, you know, the computer down on Earth knows that he's putting that zero in, you know, he can put it in any combination he wants, and it will automatically detect what he's doing up in space. And, you know, you can change this as much as you want, and nobody else would be able to figure out the message that's being passed. That's what they're more interested in. Not that they're trying to beat the speed of light. Back to you, Dick.
You got it, Roy.
Yes, Paul is quite right. It was primarily an experiment of a concept called quantum cryptography, which is a very fascinating field, which its primary reason for existing is it does away with a type of decryption spying called person-in-the-middle attack, which is if you somehow are able to tap into a transmission line, you can get the message. Well, if you tap into a quantum encrypted message, it's gibberish. And if you decrypt it, the guy at the other end is going to immediately know because the stuff he gets is going to be gibberish. So it's a fascinating concept in quantum mechanics that seems to actually be possible. So that's what they're really working at, as a way of encrypting things in an incredibly foolproof manner.
During World War II, there was an encryption machine called the Enigma, which in theory was allowing the Germans to send information to their fleet of submarines and battleships, and so that you encrypted the message at the sending end. There was a process by which the message could be de-encrypted at the receiving end, and in between you had to have a key. The setting of the dials on the Enigma machine, you could say, was the key. So a number of the secure systems today have a known process for encryption and de-encryption, but you've got to have a key in order to be able to use it. And the key might be something called the code of the day. In the case of the Enigma machine, each of the people at the receiving end had this book of codes of the day. And so on June 13th, you use this code. On June 14th, you use this other code. And if you don't have that key book, even though you may have the machine in your hands, it's not going to do you any good. And so there's various ways nowadays of using double and single keys and whatever. So there's a huge science of encryption. And by way of the machine, the computing machines becoming faster and faster, the machines are today able to find the key in some cases where previously you wouldn't live long enough. AC2GS, K2RIW, that's my little understanding on the subject.
AC2GS. Yeah, encryption is a fascinating subject in and of itself. And these really aren't codes. They're really ciphers. Codes are where words get transposed. Ciphers are where letters get transposed. You know, one of the many things about the Enigma machine is that they found a few on submarines. So they had the algorithm, and then they had some very bright mathematicians, and they had a few lazy Germans, not many, but a few, who didn't reset their devices. And they got so good at it that they realized also that a lot of messages had kind of constant information. You know, they all ended up saying Heil Hitler. So, you know, they used all kinds of great little crypto feats to accomplish this. And the High Command, the German High Command, had an even more encrypted method that Hitler sent to the generals and such. So it's all a fascinating subject. There are symmetrical encryption keys and asymmetrical encryption keys, where there are public keys for anyone to use, and a private key for the individual who it's meant to be read by is kept private. So it's all a very fascinating subject. It's highly mathematical.
One of the most elaborate encrypting schemes invented is the one that's being used by the Global Positioning Satellite. The Global Positioning Satellite has a method of operation that the common man is allowed to use, and then there's a mil-spec version which doesn't run at a 1 megabit rate, it runs at a 10 megabit rate, using an extremely long pseudo-random code. The pseudo-random code doesn't reset, it doesn't come back to zero again, so to speak, until a year and a half.
Repeater, timeout.
Until a year and a half has come about is when the code finally repeats, but it gets reset a lot sooner than that. So they've got a pseudo-random code that's got so many bits to it, at 10 million bits per second, the pseudo-random code stays thoroughly random-looking, so to speak, doesn't repeat until a year and a half in time. A year, by the way, contains something close to 10, pi times 10 to the 7 seconds per year. Rough number, pi times 10 to the 7 seconds is in a year, and if you're doing that with binary coded decimal, we can figure out how many bits it takes to do that at 10 megabits per second. It's a lot of bits. So, that code is considered very secure by today's standards. That mil-spec code for the precision locating global positioning satellite system, AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And WS2S.
quantum technology, though, is a very slippery slope. Quantum computers, if they ever figure out how to get them to work right, may be able to even make encryption keys like that useless. It's sort of amazing. I mean, I know a short version of the history of encryption. In the old days, Acrobat, the Adobe Reader, had an encryption option. I think it encrypted to 32 bits, which when it first came out was, you know, it would take you a month or a couple of months to break it. And by the time I got a look at it and Silicon got a little cheaper, I was able to break that thing in about an hour and a half. So it's amazing what a couple of years of advanced technology can do to rip apart encryption technology that was almost foolproof.
Go ahead, Paul.
On this topic, if you want to see a good movie relating to the Enigma, it's called the Imitation Game. Very well done. You learn a lot about this stuff, and it was a very entertaining show. So the Imitation Game is very well done. All about Enigma. And the story really about Alan Turing. He's the guy that really got himself wound up involved in this project. Back to you, Dave.
I've got a question for you, Roy. Stand by. You and I set a password on our computer system for our particular our email or whatever, but we've got passwords. And there are machines out there that can try every possible combination of all the letters on that, all letters and numbers and punctuation on that keyboard, and so rapidly test every possible combination, every length of password, that in a very short period of time they're going to find your password, in theory. However, if you're smart enough to set it up so that the person giving the password that wants access to your email system, for instance, is only allowed to make three attempts in a 1 minute period, and then he's going to be locked out for the next 10 minutes. If you are smart enough to set up a system like that, I don't think the person trying to break your password is going to get it. He's going to find it in a reasonable length of time. But I may be naive on that one. AC2GS, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
AC2GS. Well, that's called the brute force method. And as long as it's not a very intelligent design, yes, you just kind of keep throwing things at it until something clicks. But a lot of systems have a lockout feature. I mean, for my electronic prescriptions, it's maddening what I have to go through to link in. And there are multi attempts where you have to have a key fob with a pseudo-randomized number sequence. It can be a pain in the backside, and a lot of people get annoyed at passwords, and they'll just stick it on a post-it note and ruin it. They found recently that all these interesting suggestions about using strange characters and such doesn't work well because they just write it down on a pad of paper and stick it next to the screen. Let me drop. But there are all kinds of other ways of doing it. Keyboards produce a small amount of electromagnetic energy, and if you're smart, you can actually put a bug nearby the keyboard and record the keystrokes. And in the old days, they used to make USB devices that looked like memory sticks and such that were key loggers that would actually keep a record of every keystroke that you made, and then some guy would just pick it up and take it home, and he'd know everything about it. So there are ways around everything. There are social ways of hacking, and there are computer, mechanical, electronic hacking. There's all kinds of things. It's amazing, human nature being what it is.
Somebody tried making a transmission, but only a fraction of a syllable came through. We're going to give you a chance in a minute to try again. I worked on a number of military programs at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, where all kinds of computing was required. And in order to keep those computers secure, they had to be operated in a very special room. It was called a 100 decibel tempest-proof room. In other words, the computer itself was in the equivalent of a screen room or anechoic chamber, where the walls were good for 100 decibels of shielding. Therefore, the chances of you being outside the room, being able to listen to the electronic signal coming through the air because of the keystrokes of that keyboard, was essentially out of the question. So all the wires going into the room were properly bypassed and shielded, and the computer is in the room in a 100 dB shielded room. So when it comes to classified computing, it had to be done in that way because they were well aware 20 years ago that you could be setting up the right kind of a machine outside of the building to literally listen to the keystrokes on a keyboard and find out what the person was sending to his particular computer. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNav.
Yeah, it's spy versus spy, or cat and mouse, whatever you want to call it. It, you know, as you come up with some scheme, the other guys figure it out and block it, so you come up with another scheme, so then they block it, and over and over and over again. I mean, one of the greatest things that spies had for a while was when USB sticks first came into existence, because no one really thought of them as anything but innocuous little devices. And you could very easily talk some idiot into going to a Tempest-secured computer and plugging his damn USB stick in there and screwing everything up. So hopefully now it's a little bit more difficult. But there's always an open door someplace, somehow. It's just the way the universe, unfortunately, works.
You probably heard the story of what's called Stuxnet. Ready, go ahead.
Yes, we were devious little people. It was the United States and Israel, a bunch of very smart guys, made a government industrial-based virus that attacked centrifuges, just enough to screw things up without making it obvious. Unfortunately, it kind of escaped into the wild, and other things happened with it. But yeah, that was probably the first reported case of an actual government virus. Most viruses before then that were publicized were not government created. But yeah, I know Stuxnet.
Why don't we stand by and see if there's people who have questions or comments on what Roy has covered so far. Give us your call letters and name right now.
No.
Please continue, Roy.
Okay, I mean, I don't think there's that much to go with the Stuxnet. It was a fascinating virus. It caused the centrifuges to go out of balance and destroyed a bunch of them without leaving any obvious reason why. It was, written off as a mechanical fault, but it set back nuclear research in Iran probably 5 years. It just bollocks them. So it was highly successful.
To some degree, it's too bad that something like that has not yet been invented for North Korea.
Maybe no one can talk about it.
Understand. Roy, please continue or change subjects. The choice is yours.
One second.
Unfortunately, my computer crashed. Am I coming through on this?
You're coming through beautifully.
Okay, very good. You know, we can talk about that, or we can talk about the things that I made the links to. One of them is kind of weird, so it might be of interest to some people. I found something that's kind of vaguely similar to the M drive, that it doesn't quite make any sense, but a lot of people are interested in it. Okay, so if anyone wants to go to water.limark.tech, it's a very, very strange thing called the Mpemba effect, which states that hot objects freeze faster than cold objects.
For a number of years, a claim was made that if you put hot water in your ice tray versus cold water, and then put it in the freezer of your refrigerator, that the hot water will freeze faster. There's been a number of claims along those lines. Assuming it's true, is there a simple way of explaining the mechanism by which that takes place, Roy? Because at first it would sound like you have to wait a certain number of minutes or hours for the hot water to come down to the 0 degrees centigrade temperature, and then you start the freezing process of 80 calories per gram of going from the liquid state to the solid state. But how in the world can water that starts off hot bypass that process and do it earlier? And I think it's got something to do with the air content of hot water. AC2GS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, there's a lot of theories, there's a lot of literature on it. It's actually gotten published in physics letters, I believe. But no one has either proven it consistently, much like the M drive. Anyway, one second, I gotta finagle something. I'll be right back. Okay, I'm back. There's a whole bunch of theories. One is that it's some aspect of convection, that when it's warmer, convection has a greater evaporative effect, cooling the area. But that tends to explain the surface, doesn't really explain the core. But there's probably a half a dozen different reasons that are not quite provable, and there are some physicists out there who just don't believe it. There are some that do, there are some that don't. It's, like I said, it's very much like the M drive.
If you and I were being good scientists and we wanted to start off with a level playing field, I would start off with so-called pure water. I'm not quite sure what that means. Does that mean it's distilled water or even something that's made purer than that? But I've got two containers of identical pure water. And I've made sure that each one of them has as little air entrapped in the water as possible. Maybe I've done some kind of a vacuuming process, so to speak. So if I start off with a level playing field, where I've got two identical chunks of water, there's no contaminating air, no contaminating minerals or whatever in the water, and I start off with one tray of water at near 100 degrees centigrade, not quite boiling, and the other tray with the water maybe 1 degree centigrade, not quite freezing, and I put those two ice cube trays into the center of the freezer where they're both getting the exact same amount of cooling, and then I measure how long it takes to make ice cubes. If I tried to do a pure experiment like that, I'm having great difficulty believing that the hot water would freeze faster. AC2GS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, the original description of the Mpemba effect was actually about ice cream. The story was that this Tanzanian child made ice cream, and he found that when he put it, when it was still hot, if he put it in the freezer, it froze a lot faster than his friends who let it cool off before putting it in the freezer. So there are some people who think that there's a colloidal aspect to this phenomena that distilled water would just get lost in. So you might be right. It's one of those very, very interesting things that on the surface don't make a great deal of sense, but has generated a lot of interest amongst the
repeater. Time out.
Go right ahead, Whitey White.
I don't know the math on this, but I do know that in some of the later model aircraft that are commercially available, the ice makers actually heat the water before it's injected into the tray that is used to chill it to form the ice cube.
And you're saying that this is done on the airliner as a more efficient way of making ice cubes?
Negative. I preface this by saying I don't know why. I just know that the heater is there in the physical device in the ice maker that's available in the modern Airbus A320 family aircraft.
Well, what I think you're telling us, Hank, is that they have designed the aircraft to treat water that's about to be frozen in an ice cube tray. They have designed it in that manner for some reason, and because it took dollars and resources to do it, they must have had a good reason, is what I think you're saying, Hank. Go ahead.
That's my interpretation of it. Now, like I said, I don't know exactly why, but I assume that if somebody's taking the time and energy to build that into an ice maker for an airplane, that there's got to be a reason, because you're not terribly known, or not terribly well known for doing things on a whim.
Is your computer working so you can see the chat room or the internet communication? Somebody, I think, is trying to get through. Roy, go ahead.
I brought the chat room up, but I'm still having a little problem with EchoLink, because I have to find a place to log into it. But I should be on there in about 30 seconds.
I can tell somebody's trying to get through, but I just hear a very small fraction of one syllable of a word is all that I'm hearing. In the case of ice cream, it's a very, very complicated process. If I took the cream and the other ingredients that goes into ice cream and simply froze it, I would get something as hard as an ice cube, and you and I would be very unhappy with it. There's a lot of air that's whipped into the raw ingredients before it's frozen. So therefore, starting off with partially frozen ice cream or partially unfrozen ice cream that's been melted and then refreezing it, I think you end up with a very, very different substance at the end. AC2GS, K2LIW. Drag your feet in case anyone wants to join us.
And KC2SHO with a comment.
Aha. Now we're hearing you, John. Go right ahead, John.
Real quick, I had an ice maker once that had a heater in order to remove the ice cubes easier. K2IW, KC2SHO. Oh, have you ever heard them cracking ice cube trays on an airplane? I think not. K2IW, KC2SHO.
Yeah, in the early days, I had ice cube trays which were basically made out of aluminum. I think the modern ones are plastic. And I do remember holding the ice cube tray upside down, pouring some hot water over it from the sink, as a way of easing the process of getting the ice cubes out of the tray. So I can see how that would be a very beneficial way of doing it. But the modern day plastic ice cube trays, the ice has so little adhesion to the plastic that if you just simply twist the tray, the ice cubes kind of pop out rather easily nowadays. AC2GS, K2RIW, drag your feet again.
AC2GS, I'm back on the computer-driven radio. Well, it originated with milk, with ice cream, but it's been kind of expanded, and again, there are people postulating why it should. There are experiments that demonstrate it, but they're not consistent experiments, and a lot like the M-drive, only M-drives were so. You have this situation where sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't quite work, and there's a whole bunch of maybe reasons, but nothing's definitive. It's an interesting topic of inquiry as opposed to anything else that I thought would sort of fascinate some people out there.
Comments?
Yeah, I've got a story about the Arctic travelers, but the person who said comment, was that a joke? Go ahead, so. Sir?
A negative with Sam, KC1, SAM. It may have something to do with air bubbles. Tiny air bubbles would be a good insulator, as in styrofoam. So if you have a quantity of water with a lot of air in it, it would probably transmit or lose heat slower than water that does not have any air in it. Just a thought as I'm sitting here thinking about it. Back to you.
Yeah, air could certainly be a variable. The gram molecular weight of atmospheric air is a hell of a lot heavier than individual water molecules. A water molecule, H2O, the O is oxygen.
Well, John, when you see the recruitment of the hydrogen ions, you'll know what we're talking about.
You know, water is oxygen, which has got an atomic weight of 16, and two hydrogens, which are one each. So water molecule has an atomic weight of 18. You go through the same thing with nitrogen, oxygen. Nitrogen is N2, oxygen is O2, and the other gases. Air turns out to be an atomic weight of 29. So water as an individual molecule has a much lower atomic weight than air. It's kind of hard to believe that because water, every time you and I see it, it's in liquid form, and it certainly looks and feels heavier than air. But when that water is mixed with air on a humid day, your aircraft takes a lot longer distance to take off. So I can see air mixed into water. And even though the bubbles might be so small that you don't see them, that final mixture could have a different atomic weight. I wonder if you'd be able to detect that with a scale. If I had highly aerated water, 1 liter of it, and highly unaerated water, 1 liter of it, where when you look with your eye at a clear glass, both of them would look identical. But would I be able to measure a mass distance on a well-calibrated scale? What's your feeling on that one, Roy? AC2GS, K2LIW.
Another comment?
AC2GS. My understanding is if you correct it for the volume, if it was identical volumes and one had air in it, then it would weigh less. The trick, though, is to have the same volume of testing. If you take the same volume of water and insert and absorb air into it, the volume is going to increase by an infinitesimally greater amount, and the weight will stay pretty much the same because the air is going to be buoyant. So we'll have the same problem we had with the space man and the spacesuit.
Who is it that said that had a further comment?
That was me also, KC1, SAM. The more you warm a liquid, the less gas you can dissolve in it. So it also may figure in if you warm the water before you try to freeze it, you're squeezing or you're forcing the air out of it, and then you have less insulation in the water. Again, just what I'm thinking sitting here. Back to you, Vic.
Yeah, I think I agree with that, Sam. I've got a crazy question for you, Roy. A liter is a measure of volume, not a measure of mass. So if at standard temperature and pressure, atmospheric pressure, 70 degrees Fahrenheit, we'll say, I've got 1 liter of air in container number one, which is dry air. In container number two, I have 1 liter of air that's at very close to 100% humidity. So the volumes are the same. Which container, number one with dry air or number two with moist air, which container would weigh more? AC2GS, K2LIW.
Well, my assumption would be that the humid air would have the same mass of the 1 liter of air, but in addition would have an additional mass of the vaporized moisture. So the total would be higher. And getting back to the previous comments about insulating, you don't actually even have to consider conceiving of insulation. Ice crystals need to have places to expand. And if you dissolve oxygen gas into it, you disrupt the building of ice crystals. So you could use that as an excuse for why dissolved air screws up the freezing process.
K2CX.
CX recognized. Before I get to you, you said it backwards, Roy. If you believe in the ideal gas law, Avogadro's number is the number of molecules of gas you have in a gram molecular weight of that gas. Aircraft have much more difficulty taking off on a humid day. High humidity air is much lighter because an air molecule is 29 grams per gram molecular weight. The molecular weight of air is 29. The molecular weight of a water vapor molecule is only 18. So the high humidity air in a 1 liter container is considerably lighter, opposite of common sense. We call it heavy air. It feels heavy to us on a humid day. Our cooling system of our body doesn't work as well. Steve, Mr. CX, go right ahead, K2LIW.
Howdy, listening to you guys for a little bit here, and I'm just scratching my head, and you don't see anybody really talking about it in a way. Yeah, they say, oh yes, certain circumstances and alike. One thing is the density of water. Density of water is at 36 degrees Fahrenheit. I don't know what that is in Celsius, but water is more dense at 36 degrees Fahrenheit. And I think that has something to do with it. That's why lakes do not freeze below a certain amount from the top down, from the wind effect onto the lake. All of the water from the ice down to the bottom is 36 degrees, not taking into account other parts of, well, feeders that would be feeding it with different temperature water. That density of water has a lot to do with a lot of things.
In a liquid form, you're correct, Steve. The way it's usually stated is that water has the maximum density at 4 degrees centigrade. That when you go colder than 4 degrees centigrade, the water starts expanding. When you go hotter than 4 degrees centigrade, the water starts expanding. It has the minimum expansion or maximum density at 4 degrees centigrade. That's water in the liquid form. But water in the gaseous form, water vapor, is an air molecule, is a molecule much lighter than air molecules. So when you add water vapor to air, because of the so-called ideal gas law, you could say that Mother Nature wants you to have a given number of gaseous molecules per cubic centimeter. It's one way of simplistically saying it, not quite accurate. But the ideal gas law, the amount of spacing between all of those gas molecules is a constant. So if you take some of those air molecules and substitute them with gaseous water molecules, you end up with lighter air. And that's why an aircraft on a humid day, for two reasons, has a lot. Let me trouble. On a humid day, an aircraft has a lot more trouble taking off because on a humid day, usually the air is hotter. That makes it expand and it's lighter. But the high humidity adds another aggravating factor. The water vapor molecules in the air makes the air physically lighter. It's uncomfortable to a human being because your cooling system doesn't work as well. I wonder if you've ever heard it expressed this way before, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Density altitude.
AC2GS. No, I agree with you once again, Dick. It's a matter of displacing the air molecules for water molecules, which have lower mass. It depends upon how you pose the question. In real life, where there's one atmosphere of pressure and you add humidity, you displace the oxygen and the nitrogen and the carbon dioxide molecules, which are all heavier than H2O, and you get a lighter object. It's just, again, on the flip side, playing devil's advocate, if you injected the moisture into a 1 liter cavity of dry air, the weight would increase, but the pressure would increase as well.
Remember, we started off saying is that at standard temperature and pressure. I think Steve has another comment on the pressure altitude diagrams that they use for atmospheric air. Go ahead, Steve.
I'm looking at a graph showing two freezing rates of two water samples, and it shows almost the. One sample is at 42.9 degrees Celsius. The other is at 18.6 degrees Celsius. And they fall at a certain rate. They meet, and they actually stay at a certain distance. It shows the time in seconds. But it splits apart. The hotter water splits apart at around 8,850 seconds and starts diving quickly and more quickly than the blue line does. And with the density of the hotter liquid and the distance between the atoms, the cooling of them can be more rapid. Get that, Drew?
Yeah, why they have a different slope in the cooling process if the volume is the same and the number of BTUs being removed per second are the same. That's a little bit hard to explain. However, there's another factor going on here. There is something called supercooling. If you have water that's pure enough, and if you don't shake it during the cooling process, it's possible to get the water a considerable number of degrees below 0 degrees centigrade, and it's still in the liquid form. There's some YouTube videos that show you a person doing this with plastic bottles of water with very low vibration put into a freezer, and they take the bottle out, and you can see the bubble inside the bottle, and you're positive that what's inside is a liquid, and they strike the side of this plastic bottle, and in 2 seconds, the hold-on bottle freezes because it was super cooled. So there's this crazy characteristic where water carefully cooled may not form ice at 0 degrees centigrade. I wonder if you've ever seen that YouTube video, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Comment, anyone, why do I?
Yes, I've seen there's a lot of YouTubes on saturation where you just throw in any little speck of something and the entire bottle solidifies. It's a really nice video, and there are many, many people who've done it. And that's one of the rationales that have been used for the Mpemba effect and why they cite the colloidal aspects of ice cream making as a possible way of that making the difference. But yeah, that was included. There's a laundry list of people's ideas of what might be causing it. And unfortunately, although the gentleman has a nice looking graph, sometimes guys will try and generate a graph like that, and it ends up being a mess. So it's not a consistent thing, unfortunately.
I'll wait for the beep, and you've got a tank.
Thanks, Dick. I just want to throw my 2 cents in also about aircraft performance during takeoff with moist air. And while everything you said is correct, there is one aspect to it we didn't bring up, and that is if you displace, you add moisture to air, you're in effect displacing some oxygen that would normally be available to the engine for combustion, either in a jet or in a reciprocating engine. So that's one of the issues that really affects aircraft performance when takeoff, is you simply cannot get as much performance because you don't have as much oxygen available in combustion. And the other comment I wanted to make is talking about the super cooled water and freezing. And that's actually what they think brought down the Air France flight that crashed out of Brazil a number of years back, if you remember. And there was a whole series of things, but the initial problem was that they flew into some super cooled air, and it unfortunately froze to the aircraft.
And the heater that was on the pitot tube that was measuring the velocity being fed into the automatic flight computer was no longer getting information. And then so that began the process. The computer complained that you can't fly the airplane because it's not getting a reasonable reading of air velocity. After that, the co-pilot that was doing much of the flying was using a lot of up elevator. He eventually put the aircraft into a stall, but because he wasn't getting good air readings out of airspeed readings out of that pitot tube, he didn't know that. All he knew is that the controls were starting to become inoperative. Isn't that a little bit about what was going on, Hank? Over to you, Hank, K2LAW.
Pretty much, Dick. What actually I believe happened, based on what I've read, is that the PETA heater was, the tube that the airspeed is measured is a combination, and the one that faces forward is called a PETA tube, and then on the side of the aircraft is something called a static port, and they have multiple systems. But unfortunately, the PDOT heaters, the things that are supposed to keep the PDOT tube from freezing over, was inoperative and not properly indicating its status to the pilots. And unfortunately, the air data computer, which is the computer you were talking about, wasn't smart enough to recognize that it was getting bad data. So everything kept trying to work as if everything was normal. And because the data was bad that it was getting, every input that either the pilots made or the computer made just aggravated the situation. If somebody had recognized what was going wrong in the first few seconds, it would have been an easier problem to resolve than by the time all the computers were complaining and the aircraft was pitched up because the co-pilot was pulling back. He thought he was going faster than he was. There's a whole article that the NTSB published about it. It's interesting reading, but it essentially comes down to they weren't able to get good air data information, and unfortunately they reacted poorly to that.
And I think I read that the recommended procedure, once you know that your PETO airspeed indicator is not telling you the truth, I think the recommendation to get out of that situation is to use something like 3/4 thrust and a certain amount of artificial horizon nose pitch up, like something like 3 degrees of nose up and 3/4 thrust, knowing that under normal conditions that will keep you out of a stall and allows you to climb and hopefully eventually get out of this unreasonable air condition. I think that was close to one of the recommended procedures. Back to you, Hank, K2LAW.
Again, very close. What you're trying to describe when you talk about 3/4 thrust and how many degrees ANU, aircraft nose up, that is the very basic concept of pitch plus power equals performance. And there is a pitch attitude that the aircraft has relative to the rise and a certain amount of performance or power that's available from the engine And if you set up these combinations to what you know works in cruise flight, it will give you cruise performance when you're flying. It won't let you climb. I mean, you still have to, if you wanted to climb, go to a higher power setting than 3/4 of, you know, we'd say something like 75% or 80%. Normally, and these are actually measured of one of the two spools in the engine, so there's a high pressure and a low pressure section, and usually the low pressure section, which is the N1, is the number you're using. So you go to a, you know, either an EPR setting or an N1 setting that gives you approximately 75%, and you'll get standard cruise performance as the aircraft flies. N1 YDY.